This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Liv and Lynn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's our Feminist Friday show today, and joining me for this episode is Suri Kempe. She is the Program Manager for Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment at the United Nations Development Program Malaysia, and she's also a feminist and human rights activist. So Suri has been on BFM many times before discussing a wide range of issues, covering such as the policing of women's bodies and even gender equality in the media. But today we are discussing something a little bit closer to both our hearts, actually, feminist parenting and how to raise a feminist child. Welcome, Suri. How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks, Juliet. And thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming in. I suppose the first thing that I want to know is how would you describe your own upbringing? You know, were you raised as a feminist?
I don't think it was a conscious decision on my mother's part to raise me as a feminist. I think there's certain aspects of my upbringing, like because she's a single mother, and she put both me and my sister through college. She was always quite adamant about impressing upon us that women can be independent and are independent, and look at her and how far she's come and how she's been able to raise us, you know, and ensure that come what may, our education was important, and that she was going to, by hook or by crook, make sure that we had a good education. And on top of that, I think just watching her basically support my entire extended family. So my grandmother, to a certain extent, I think she supported my her brother's family as well, where she could. Mm-hmm. She's a doctor, so she ran her own clinic. She's the first, I think the first person in the family to ever enter and graduate from university. So, you know, it was a big deal to see her be that successful. And I think her background was, she came from a very poor family. My grandparents were very poor. And so seeing her move up this way, and then not only that, carry shoulder that responsibility for supporting the entire family, I think was huge. And she, granted, you know, there was support from my grandmother in terms of caring for us and whatnot. But to a large extent, I owe my independence and in the way I think I navigate life generally to her because of how she was, how strong she was, you know. So yes, so it wasn't a conscious decision on her part. And I think she was also raised at that time where I think there was starting to be a backlash on in terms of feminism, you know. Feminism or feminists were seen more so in the Western context, you know, as bra burning, man hating women. So in that sense, I don't think she ever identified herself as a feminist, for example, but she made very sure that we knew as girls and as women, we had the potential to sit in this world as equals, and that there was nothing that was stopping us from being independent and to move forward and to grab opportunities that came before us.
So you identify as a feminist, am I correct?
I do, yes.
And why do you think that's so important to, you know, to say that I am a feminist?
I think my journey towards becoming a feminist took some time. It initially, I might have been somewhat uncomfortable as well with that label, simply because I think I hadn't thought about the nuances or sat down to give myself time to think what that really meant. But a lot of my work, starting from my university days, as I worked with at the university as a diversity education specialist, and then moving on and dealing with various issues related to diversity, and then focusing on gender in particular and women's empowerment, both at the ministry level, I worked with government for a bit, and then at the NGO level with civil society when I worked with Sisters in Islam, I think really helped solidify that identity for me, and that there was nothing shameful in being a feminist. That I was proud, in fact, to call myself a feminist, because it meant that I would not apologize, and I was unapologetic about seeing men and women as equals in this world. And there was nothing, including religion, that denied that possibility.
So you have a daughter. How did your feminism intersect with your role as a mother?
That was, I think, to a certain extent, being a feminist means holding on to certain values, seeing that women's contributions and existence even are equally valued as that of boys and men.
Yeah.
And in terms of how it affected me as a mother, that was something I wanted to consciously impart on my daughter. I think it had a very direct impact on the types of values that I wanted to impart and teach my daughter. Sometimes, of course, reality or society
rears its ugly head
and sends different signals to my daughter or my parenting, you know, skill. And it's a continuous process of reinforcing and checking which strategies, which messages resonate the most and how we can impart those values. But I think that's all part and parcel of parenting, isn't it?
Of course, yes. I mean, feminist parenting should just be a rule for parenting, I think.
But correct, exactly.
So when you knew you were having a daughter, I suppose, was there a very conscious decision to raise her as a feminist? I mean, and would that have changed if you had had a son instead?
No, actually. It wouldn't have made a difference, mm-hmm. I think, if I had a boy or a girl. I mean, I was talking to a friend about this, and, she was asking me, well, what kind of values are feminist values? And I started talking about the equality of men and women, this, that, and the other. And she said, you know, the more you talk about it, the more it just sounds like general rules on how to be a good person and how to be a good human being.
Precisely.
You know? And so I think if I had had a son, I would have imparted those very same values to him. Mm-hmm. It just so happened that I had a daughter, a quite headstrong one and with a lot of sass.
Wonder where she gets it from.
But, I don't think it would have made a difference.
Okay. And you kind of mentioned just now that, you know, some people might not agree with your parenting style. So, I mean, have you actually had conflicts with others, you know, I suppose, for lack of a better word, who are messing with your parenting style?
No one's ever chastised me or said, oh, you shouldn't be doing that, except maybe my mom, who said, you know, who was quite horrified when I started teaching Zuli, and that's my daughter's name, about sex ed from a very young age.
Okay.
I mean, it was age appropriate, granted, but, you know, as a four-year-old, and at that point I was working with Dato' Sri Sherizat at the Ministry of Women. And, you know, when she was running around identifying everybody with their genitalia, you know, oh, you're a boy, you have a penis, you're a girl, you have a vagina, on the minister's floor, my mom was quite horrified. And she's like, see, this is what happens when you teach children how to name their genitals, you know. And so she was quite horrified. But otherwise, I don't think I've ever been reprimanded for those particular values. In fact, I think I've had questions about, you know, like how to impart certain values on raising strong children or strong daughters from other parents. I've had one parent who snapped a picture of Zuli climbing a tree at school and was like, oh, look, she's climbing a tree. And I said, you know, well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Good for her.
Yeah, good for her. And I think when my daughter came back from school, she said, oh, so-and-so reprimanded me for climbing a tree. I was like, well, it was quite a low tree. It wasn't like there was a risk of you falling. Mm-hmm. So I think it was, you know, it's fine. I think it's fine that she sent that to me as a precaution in case something happened to you. But, you know, if there's short trees like that, just go ahead and climb.
But because you are consciously raising her as a feminist, right? And the word feminism itself has a very bad rep, a very unfair one. I'm sure we both agree. But mm-hmm. How do you go about destigmatizing that word, especially in your interactions with your family and your daughter, especially?
I know as feminists, we tend to use a lot of jargon.
Yeah.
I think.
The patriarchy.
The patriarchy. and feminism. And feminism, I think, is one of those things that as a word is harder to grasp than the concept itself. Mm-hmm. You know, how you value, exactly. Equally value women and men. And so I try to steer clear, especially because she's 9 going 10 this year. I tend to steer clear of jargon as much as possible. Sometimes it slips out and she'll be like, what is that? What is the patriarchy? And I'll struggle to unpack it for her in one word because it's the convenience of jargon, right?
Yeah,
of course. It's something that's quite easy, but in terms of trying to explain it to a child, it makes it more difficult. But if people say, oh, feminists are this, and she comes back and it's just like, oh, mom, you know, someone said feminists are bad, or this is unfair, or whatever.
They all hate men, for example.
Yeah, they all hate men, and they're all terrible people. Then, you know, it's, you can unpack that and actually just say, well, do you think boys and girls should be equally acknowledged and praised or valued? Well, valued again is another loaded, is another heavy word. And so she'll be like, yeah, should boys and girls be treated the same? Yes. Should they have the same chances? Should they have the same opportunities? Should they be able to do the same things? Yes. Well, is that terror? Is that bad? No. Well, that's what feminism is. So, you know, so it's unpacking it that way for her.
In a very practical way, of
yes,
course.
Yes, yes, exactly.
I'm speaking today to Suri Kempe. She is a feminist and human rights activist, and she's also the program manager for gender equality and women's empowerment at the UNDP office in Malaysia. And we are discussing feminist parenting, or how to raise a feminist. We will continue our discussion after this short break. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. It's Feminist Fridays today, and in the studio with me is Suri Kempe. She is a feminist and human rights activist, and she's also the program manager for gender equality and women's empowerment at the United Nations Development Programme Malaysia. So, and we are discussing how to be a feminist parent and how to raise a feminist. So I think we all remember that Barack Obama, he penned that very long, nice op-ed about how he is a feminist. This is what a feminist looks like. And he put a picture of himself. And, you know, some of the things he said is that we need to change that attitude that raises our girls to be demure and our boys to be assertive, that criticizes our daughters for speaking out and our sons for shedding a tear. Basically, we need to keep changing the attitude that punishes women for their sexuality and rewards men for theirs. I mean, before we get into that, how important do you think it was for a man, an important man like him, to say something like that, to come out and publicly say something like that?
I think it's very important. I think men can carry or embody feminist values. And I think it's very important for someone who is in a position of power to validate that. I mean, if you look at how he backed, say, for example, sexuality rights and LGBT rights in a very public way, mm-hmm. I think that shifted a lot of opinions. And I think the same goes for identifying oneself as a feminist and being able to put weight behind those words, and especially if you're being looked at by an entire country, I think by the entire world, in terms of how you treat the women in your life and the women around you. And I think it's even more important, not only in terms of how he raises his daughters, but also in terms of how he walks his talk, in terms of the women he puts into positions of power, the number of women he appoints to his cabinet, for example. Those are very walk-the-talk actions that people in power have the capacity and the ability to do. And that's why, beyond lending words, I think it's also lending actions to put weight behind that.
Do you think, you know, I mean, he was, the reason it came out when it did was just during the presidential election, that he was doing this as a result of how Trump had, I suppose, referred to women in all his speeches and how he was treating Hillary Clinton, for that matter, you know, nasty woman, those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it could have been. And if it was, it was also done quite tactfully, not necessarily in an attacking way, but in a way that stated what for him was important and what was right. I mean, that points to the other side of the coin, right? Which is, you need men in power and who have authority to be able to support and lend their weight to feminism, for example. But, I mean, there's also the counter, which is men who behave in very misogynistic ways. And those are the men that, you know, the country sees, our politicians and how they treat women, the things they say about women, you know, leaky pipes. Yeah. And I remember that leaky pipes comment by a particular MP in Parliament about her period.
Yeah.
You know, about women drivers, for example, and how they're terrible. When obviously the reverse is true. If you look at the statistics, the statistics will reveal that it is men who, you know, have a higher chance of accidents, have a higher rate of accidents than women in this, women drivers. So a lot of those things set an example and set a precedent for how other men value women in this country and the debates that surround it, you know. I remember just recently there was a women's march for International Women's Day. And there was a young girl who held up a sign that said, "I want to be the first female prime minister in the country." But you know why that's impossible, or why that won't happen? And then below that was a little speech bubble that said, "Mane tudung."
Oh, dear God.
So, I mean, that was her little poster or her placard for the march. And the picture of it was snapped and it went viral. Unsurprisingly, or unfortunately, she received a lot of attacks.
Of course. And
it was mostly from young men, you know, basically cussing her out, talking about her parents, saying how, you know, she was dressed inappropriately. But when you think about it, really, her placard wasn't even that controversial.
No.
It just said, you know, it made a statement about her wanting to be the first prime minister. And they're
aspirational,
really,
yeah.
Exactly. And it really wasn't that controversial. It wasn't a
condemnation of men, for example.
Precisely. But the amount of backlash and misogyny that was evident in the comments and the attacks that and the harassment she received thereafter. Mind you, this is a girl of 15, is really evident about how women are perceived as threats. And even something aspirational like that can be perceived as a threat by men. And what, again, that points to how unequally women are valued in this country. Yes, it is a general global problem, but I think in this particular case, in this country, by society at large.
And I suppose it also goes back to who are teaching these men that this is how you can treat a woman.
Precisely. So it's one thing to see other men in power denigrate women and treat them in ways that are inferior and submissive and generally in a lower position like that, mm-hmm. And make fun of them and attack their person. I mean, look at the women. Look at what happens when women run for the elections. You know, when women politicians run, instead of focusing on the content of what they're speaking about, they get attacked by on their looks. You know, and any personal
attack. Dressing also.
Exactly, you know. On their looks, on their dressing, about whether they are soft and gentle and feminine enough. Not about their content, you know, not about what principles they stand for, about how they will govern, about what changes they want to bring about. Those aren't the questions that are directed at women. But you'll never see the same for men. I mean, if we held men to the same aesthetic standard that we hold women to, my God, I think we just wouldn't have men politicians.
And also, you know, it goes back to MPs just attacking each other, because I know there's one female MP who was attacked by another male MP saying, "Oh, I really pity her husband. She's, you know, she's so bossy." Remember that?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So if the people in power are like that, well, anyway, going back to parenting, I suppose, you know, raising them to not be like that for a future generation. You yourself, what are some practical ways that you're tackling a feminist upbringing for your daughter? So I suppose I'm talking about things like toys and activities, you know, gendered roles and how you address those things.
I mean, when she was a baby, I was very conscious about gender-neutral colors and gender-neutral toys. But as I said, society is a teacher as well. And as she grew up, she started liking a lot of girly things. You know, she went through a whole pink phase, and that pink phase lasted longer than I had the stomach for. That lasted a couple of years, you know. So she went through pink bags and pink toys and Barbie dolls. And I came to realize that that's okay, you know, because we make the effort to sensitize. I made the effort to sensitize my daughter and say, but the idea is, I guess, that as much as she likes pink, she doesn't have to like it because she's a girl. If she likes it, fine. You know, you can like it. That's yeah. fine. I won't stop you. But don't feel like you cannot like blue. Don't feel like you cannot like green or yellow or anything else. And now she's shifted from a pink phase to a blue phase and a black phase. And that's okay too. So to like those colors simply because she likes them, that's fine. You know, I'm quite happy with that. Her clothes, she goes through different phases as well. You know, to be honest, she likes to do her hair, and you know, she watches YouTube videos on how to braid her hair, and those are typically what we would say are, you know, feminine or girly things to do.
Yeah,
and I won't say they're bad; they just are, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I don't want her to feel inhibited for liking to do things that are traditionally associated with boys or masculine things either. She likes to do archery, or initially at one point she liked playing football and rollerblading and doing, you know, very, very athletic things. That's fine, you know, and I don't, it's basically just being conscious about not ascribing particular gender norms and gender roles to her and what she likes to do. So if she likes art, go for it. What do you like to paint? Horror, blood and gore for at one point. You know, she went through a Halloween phase and drew really horrible monsters. And, you know, I was just like, okay, well, fine. Go ahead. Get it out of your system.
Yeah.
That's fine. I won't condemn you and say, oh, girls don't draw pictures like this. Why don't you draw pictures of happy things?
Unicorns.
Unicorns.
Rainbows.
Exactly. Rainbows, My Little Ponies. Yeah. But no, I mean, you know, she can do whatever she wants in that sense. I think it's important for them to be able to process that and get it out. And if she wants to draw unicorns, then by all means,
exactly.
draw unicorns. But if not, if you want to draw a graveyard with monsters popping out of it, that's fine too.
And what about things like being body positive, you know, not ascribing to look a certain, this of course is, I suppose, you know, girls should be slim and, you know, look very girly, long hair and everything. Or boys, they need to be very tough and masculine. How do you sort mm-hmm. of impart that to her, that there's no, I don't know, I mean, how would you tackle that?
I mean, Zuli's she's solid, yeah? She's not fat or overweight in that sense. She's just quite solid. Mm-hmm. And I've had comments from parents that have told me to put her on a diet.
She's 9.
Right. And those comments came when she was 7, yeah?
Oh,
put her on a diet, have her eat less, be conscious of et cetera. And I appreciate that they come from a good place. You know, they can, you know, just make sure your child doesn't get obese kind of thing. I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt because, you know, people's intentions can come from a good place. So, but I've tried to resist those and stop from calling her fat, or sometimes, you know, it'll slip out in conversations where, you know, but it hurts her feelings.
Of
it
course.
Absolutely does. But for the most part, she's gotten really positive reinforcements. I mean, I'm a single mom at this point, which means that I have a village of friends who help me raise my daughter.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky in that way because they always give her positive reinforcement about her body. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not fat, you're strong and muscular, and that's good. You know, you need the strength to be able to do all the things that you like to do, to go rollerblading. And because of that, I think she feels rather proud of her body. I think there are insecurities, granted, because she gets teased for being fat. And she, at one point, she came back from school or crying because some girls had called her fat and big and all that. But I think sitting down and talking to her about how to manage these critiques and how to respond to them, what to say, not to get too frustrated or disheartened by them, helps her a lot. And, you know, a couple of months down the road, she'll be like, oh, you know, Mom, when you said this to me, it really helped me a lot. And I thought when she sat down with me and, you know, like, yeah. it really helped, made me feel better about how I looked. Yeah. So in that sense, I think it's a constant process because these negative reinforcements, they come from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They come from TV. They come from friends at school. They come from other parents who might drop comments which unintentionally do hurt her feelings, you know. But it is a constant, and she's quite sensitive too. So it's a constant conversation about trying to make her feel like, you know, that there's nothing to be ashamed about in terms of her physique.
Okay. And are you also teaching her to question language? You know, I mean, I'm guessing she has access to social media and newspapers and things like that. And there's always very, I suppose, gendered writing in some of the things that are written out there. Like, for example, just off the top of my head, I remember that they're talking about Theresa May. And the thing that they wrote was, her husband allowed her to be in a position of power. Those sorts of things, you know. Are you asking your daughter to sort of understand what is sexist and what is not, like that statement that I just gave, for example?
Right.
That is
yes.
Not.
I mean, definitely, especially when it comes to unpacking movies, you know, more so than writing, I think, because a lot of the books that she has happen to be quite, I mean, I'm quite particular about the books that she reads.
Okay.
And so they usually have strong female characters, you know, so in that sense, it's a lot from movies or if girls aren't allowed to do this, why aren't girls allowed to do this, she'll ask, you know. Yeah. Why is it weird for this girl to want to be the head detective, for example?
Right.
So, or we can, we'll ask her questions like that, or she will come back down after watching a cartoon or whatever and she'll ask, why is this weird? Why are they attacking her for behaving like this?
It's wonderful that she can identify it.
Yeah, yeah. So those are conversations that we have. But I think also this language of allowing, I think as a huge dimension, like there's a power dimension dynamic behind it. And so, you know, to allow someone to do it, I think right now she mostly identifies with parenting. Can I, you know, it's like permission to do something.
Yeah.
And so I think the nuances, I think that's a little bit more sophisticated. And, you know, if she goes or if she watches the news sometimes with me, she'll ask, I think, more simplistic questions. But I think as she goes along, those are questions that will come up. You know, this language of allowing women to rise, men allowing women to rise to particular positions of power or to occupy particular public spaces. Those are nuances, I think, that she has picked up sometimes and I hope will continue to question. But it's definitely something that I emphasize in raising her, yeah.
And are you also raising her to speak up when she sees the need to? So like I said, I think it's great that she can identify that there's something wrong somewhere, you know, why is this happening, right? So do you actually encourage her to speak up, you know, not just to you, but to maybe her friends or if she sees some injustice? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's part of being feminist as well, right?
Yeah.
If you see inequality or if you see someone being treated unfairly, not only because on the basis of gender or sex, but because of any other reason, like are they being bullied because they're big or fat? Are they being bullied because they're too small? Are they being bullied because they're abled or disabled?
Poor, rich, who knows?
Rich, poor, exactly. Then to speak up. And I hope she does it at school. She tells me sometimes that she does. So I do tell her, ask her to speak up. And sometimes I think it takes courage. And that courage is something that we need to nurture. It doesn't come automatically because social forces are a really big challenge, in particular, I think, for young children. She, because of her tendency to talk a lot and speak up, it also comes with a price, yeah, which means you're not necessarily well-liked.
Mm.
You know, so this idea of likability, right, becomes an issue. And I think for her, for a while, she was quite sad that it was difficult for her to make friends. And that is a big pressure, I think, social pressure for her. And so, of course, when you're 9, when you're 8, when you're 7, you want to be liked.
Yeah.
Of course you do. I think to the extent that parenting goes, you know, I watched and sometimes you have to navigate social spaces in a way that is most appropriate for a particular setting. And I may have ideas about how she should behave, but I think there's also value in letting her test her own skills and figure out her own way.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks towards independence and letting a child grow up and make mistakes and fail and then pick themselves up and get up again. And I think as difficult as it is to watch, because sometimes she'll come home from school crying, you know. It is about allowing her to make those mistakes and then being able to navigate social spaces, like making friends, without compromising who she is. And if something really is wrong, then to speak up, you know, or to be able to say, if you want me to take money from that girl to be, you know, to be my friend, because she's a big girl, yeah. And there have been cases where I think she's been asked by other girls to take money from someone else.
Oh my goodness.
because she's big. She's big. Yeah. So she's like, you know, the bouncer.
she's the tug, yeah.
Yeah. So exactly. So in those instances, to be able to say no or stand your ground and say, if you don't want to be my friend, that's fine, is something she had to learn. She made the mistake and she apologized for it later. But those are all lessons, yeah? I mean, that's what kids do. Kids make mistakes and that's okay. I think being forgiving about that is one thing, but also being able to tell them what's right and what's wrong, and then being able to have them play that out in their own social settings without parental supervision is important.
Yeah.
Of course, and, you know, when that happened, I had other parents call me, and it was like a little parent conference call. but I think, I mean, I was really quite lucky to have parents that understood, parents that were quite forgiving as well, and that allowed these children to do what they needed to do, to learn, most importantly. Yeah.
But it's these
little things which seem minor but are so important as children grow up to develop, right? What is the right thing to do? How do you stop yourself from oppressing others?
Exactly.
Right? And yep. When do you hold a position of privilege in a certain context and then recognize it and say, I will not abuse that and abuse someone else or make someone else feel terrible for what I have. So it's that. And sometimes it's a little, it's not as straightforward as my thing, because there's home and there's everything you try and teach at home. And then there's school.
Oh, yes.
And then there's other reinforcements, you know, friends, peer pressure and whatnot. But it's a journey. And, you know, as much as I want her, for all the teaching that I'm doing or for all the values that I'm trying to impart, I may want her to turn out one way, but she may turn out completely differently. And that's beyond my control. And I think it's healthy for me to recognize that, you know?
I think it's healthy for all
parents.
You can't
push them in a particular box.
You can teach them the lessons, but
right,
whether they do live up to the way you imagine them to be, that
precisely, and that's my lesson in this, because parenting is also, you know, it's not as we traditionally understand it. Parents know everything, or mother knows best, and stuff like that. It's also learning from experience and learning from them and learning how they react. Sometimes they want or require to be taught in different ways. Sometimes that lesson is imparted, you know, in very, very different ways than we think it should be.
Yeah. And, you know, just going back to that, you know, speaking up and you know, being forthright, like you mentioned about that 15-year-old girl, you know, she faced such
backlash, yeah.
Right? I mean, have you sort of warned your daughter about that happening? I mean, obviously she faced it in her own little way that she wasn't likable, I say in inverted commas, but, you know, are you sort of preparing her that is going to happen, you know, online trolling and things like that, if she does speak out in a public forum, for example?
So she's 9 and most of her friends have Instagram. Mm-hmm. So she was trying to pester me for an Instagram account. Phone, you know, she wanted a phone and she wanted an Instagram account. And I was like, no, you can't. And she's like, why not? Mm-hmm. And as much as I tried to speak about it, I came across an article that talked about a mother's experience about how her 11-year-old was groomed by a pedophile through Facebook. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, in the same way how her daughter was asking her for a Facebook account and how she'd put up some general rules. And of course, her daughter broke one of the rules, and it resulted in this guy trying to befriending her on chat,
yep.
and then I think exposing himself to her via video chat.
Right.
And as an 11-year-old, and I mean, the mother was talking about how much she regretted that her child's first sexual encounter was that.
Yeah.
And even though I tried to convey that story to Zuli, she was stubborn enough. So I was like, you know what? Just read the article. Read the article. And she was like, oh. And she was quite intent about reading it and read out parts that she didn't understand or words that she didn't understand. And we discussed it after.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, okay, I kind of get it now. So if I want to use the internet or any social media stuff, downstairs in the family room, you know?
Yeah.
Something like that. So not that we have a shared computer at home. We just don't. Not yet, anyway. But I think a lot of caution. I think we're quite lax, or we haven't quite caught up yet with what it means to have our young children, children as young as 9, for example, online, and how that exposes them to a completely new world or a different world, opens them up to so much risk.
One that's very hard for you to look after.
Precisely,
them
and we can't. You can't monitor them all the time.
Yeah.
And they need to be able to take some responsibility. But at 9, at 10, you know, and that's my constant struggle as well. As much as I want to be able, like, some learning happens with independence, but there are some risks I don't think I'm prepared to take just yet.
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to social media, like Instagram and even having a telephone that goes beyond the basic calls, sorry, darling, you can't have a phone just yet, you know? I'm not quite prepared to do that yet because I don't think I would be stringent enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would rather say no at this point.
Yeah, and just face the teenage backlash when it comes, right?
Right. I mean, but after reading the article and after the discussion, she stopped asking.
Okay. That's wonderful, though, that she can, you know, recognize that my mom is not just being difficult, that there are real concerns behind this, why she's making me do this.
That's right.
Or not allowing me to do
this. That's right. And, you know, exactly.
Yeah. Just going on to language. I personally never use the word bossy with my daughter because I use assertive. She's very young. She's only 21 months old, but she's already a very assertive child. But I've had some people calling me, oh, you're so politically correct. You know, you can use the word bossy. It doesn't matter. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on that? You know, how important do you think language is, you know, the language we use ourselves and the language that we use on them?
I think it's absolutely important. And I think the language that we use sets the tone for the language that we use later in their lives. They might say, oh, she's just 21 months old. She might not understand yet. Doesn't make a difference. But I think it also is training for us.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we call her bossy at 21 months old, you know, at the age of 21 months, then other people hear us calling her that. And that sets the tone for everybody else as well as us. And then it becomes habit and habit forming. And then it becomes a norm. You normalize it and then it becomes part of their psyche. My sister, at one point, I think my sister has 2 sons and they're much younger than Zuleika. And I think she sent, and she's in Australia at the moment, and she sent a picture of him on a little merry-go-round, and he was commanding all his friends not to fall off, not to do this and not to do that. It was really adorable, and I love him. But I was quite conscious when she said, oh, look at him being a little leader. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's being bossy. because I'm quite conscious about how, like, I think Zuli would have been called bossy.
For sure.
You know, and it's quite interesting that the language that was used for to describe my nephew was leader. And so I am very conscious about language. And even when, because she is assertive, she talks a lot and she's very opinionated, to the point where sometimes she interrupts people because she has so many opinions she wants to share, you know? I try as much as possible to not put her down by saying, you know, you're so bossy and you need to be quiet. And because it's not about that. It's about etiquette at a certain point. You know, it's about manners, really. Stop interrupting us when we're having a conversation. You need to wait your turn. Everybody waited. So you need to wait as well. And then you can speak, you know, and she'll be like clenching her teeth on the side and just jumping around on the sidelines, just being like, I want to talk, I want to talk, I want to talk, I want to talk, you know.
Bless.
But it's about that more than anything. And I think language does make a huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I mentioned, it is training for ourselves.
Yeah.
And how we shape our own use of language and the people around us. Because if mom calls, or mom or dad call child bossy, it's okay. It sends a signal that it's okay for everybody else to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, because you've allowed it already.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You set the standard. And if that's the standard you want for your child, if that's what you want your child to be called, then that's what other people are going to do.
Yeah.
Other people are going to follow your lead because it is your child.
Yeah. I suppose then the question is, you know, how do we empower boys and girls to understand that there's no single way to be. Boys can play with dolls if they wanted to, girls can play football if they wanted to, you know, and I guess to understand that, you know, difference is the only universal thing in this world.
I think that's a good question. And I think to the extent possible, I think that's why it's so important to break out of gender roles and raise our children as, you know, so my daughter has to do her own dish after dinner, because that's what everybody does. Everybody washes their own dishes. Not because she's a girl. She doesn't have to clean her room because she's a girl. She has to do it because she lives in this house and I don't want to live in a pigsty, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
My house will not be this dirty. And no, if you leave fruits on the floor, then cockroaches are going to come, you know? You have to be a clean person. And with my nephews, when they are older, because right now they're just two and one, they'll be held to that same standard.
Yeah.
not because of their sex, not because they're boys, but because they, you know, that's just the rule in the house.
Yeah.
They'll need to take out the trash. My daughter takes out the trash. They'll need to fold their clothes. They'll need to wash their own, you know, it's that. And I think that's why it's so important. And I think as much as we try and raise our children to see beyond gender, we also cannot pretend that we live in a genderless world. I think there is a risk in pretending that gender doesn't exist because it is the basis for oppression in this day and age. Women are still lagging behind men when it comes to so many aspects, social, political, economic, you know, aspects. And therefore, it is important to be able to point it out to our children. And it's important for me to point it out to Zuli to say, look, when this happens, when you are told that you can't play football, that girls, because you're a girl, that girls shouldn't play football, that you're teased, that you're this, that you're that, because you're a girl, that is nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
It is sexist. That is, you know, you're not being allowed to. And sometimes I use the word sexist and she'll be like, what's sexist, mom? But it's being able to explain it in her context. It's when you're being told that you can't play football because girls don't play football.
Mm-hmm.
And that's nonsense. You see me play football. She's like, that's what I told them. You know? So it is important to try and aspire to raise them to look beyond gender roles, but we have to be able to point out when sexism happens because that is the reality. And we want them to be able to see that and know that it's wrong and do something about it.
Just to conclude, Suryo, sorry, we're running out of time. One of the questions I always get is, you know, why not teach them humanism instead of feminism? I mean, this question, of course, infuriates me because it shows a lack of understanding to what feminism means. But I mean, how would you respond to something like that if someone said that to you?
I think feminism means equality between men and women, right?
Yes.
It is simply valuing the contributions of women as much as you do those of men, and seeing them as equals. And I think there's an inherent power dimension that feminism speaks to, that we need to be able to point out. Humanism, I mean, tell me, we spoke about this earlier.
Yeah.
Tell me what you understood by humanism.
So, okay, I think they are taking the term humanist, which is actually a movement that, you know, says that you should be good based on the fact that you are a human being, not because you will go to heaven or you'll go to hell. It's your duty, I suppose, as a human being to be kind, to be good, to treat everyone equally, not because of, you know, otherworldly forces, for example. So that is actually what humanist means. But I think what these people are trying to say is, why do we have to tag the word feminism, which has this, you know, implication of women?
So you
only
should be good. You should treat women equally.
Yeah,
is what they're saying. Just because it's the right thing to do.
They said that. I guess what they're trying to say is, why must you talk only about women? Why not? It's like, you know, Black Lives Matter, all lives matter.
Right, right.
It's that
right.
kind of argument, I think.
Because, and I think, again, humanism, especially when compared in that particular context to feminism, sounds just like a way not to offend people. Mm-hmm. Because it inherently misses that historically women have been oppressed and are a step below, are in an oppressed category in comparison to men. Mm-hmm. And I think it misses that. To say to everyone, oh, you should just be humanist, is almost like you're missing that historical aspect of why women are fighting for equality.
Exactly.
And in order to fix it, you need to be, I think we need to be intellectually honest with ourselves about what is happening and where women are at and why women are in the position they're at. If we're just like, hey, let's all be good. Let's all work hard. Let's all try our best because everybody tries their best. I think it's somewhat delusional and misses the point. And you can't address a problem if you refuse to acknowledge its roots.
Exactly.
So, yes, that's why feminism and not humanism.
Thank you so much, Suri. Thank you for joining us today. I've been speaking to Suri Kempe. She's a feminist and human rights activist and also the program manager for gender equality and women's empowerment at the United Nations Development Program in Malaysia. And we were discussing feminist parenting and raising a feminist. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.